For WKU Public Radio, I'm Kevin Willis. We're living through one of the golden eras for Kentucky's most famous export to the world, bourbon. Worldwide demand for bourbon has never been higher, and certain small batch or single barrel versions of the whiskey have achieved cult-like followings and sell out as soon as they hit the market. Michael Veach is the author of a new book entitled Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey and American Heritage. Veach is associate curator of special collections at the Filson Historical Society in Louisville. Veach used his training as an historian to comb through documents and archives detailing bourbon's colorful past. He told us that writing an accurate history of bourbon involved debunking a lot of myths that have grown up throughout the years, like the myth that bourbon is named after Bourbon County, Kentucky.
As to where the term bourbon came from, yeah, I would love to be able to prove that it was named after Bourbon County. But the more I look at it, the more I found that I just couldn't do that. So my theory, and this is just a theory because I have no concrete proof, is that it's probably named after Bourbon Street in New Orleans instead of Bourbon County. My main reasons for saying that is because the earliest reference I found to Bourbon County being the origin of the name Bourbon was like in the 1870s. You know, nothing contemporary. Bourbon County, you know, the legend has it that it was named Bourbon because there were invoices from Bourbon County on these flatboats that were shipping goods out of Maysville, what was called Limestone at the time. The problem is that limestone was only part of Bourbon County for a couple of years, and in those years there was very little trade going on between Kentucky and New Orleans because the Spanish were using it as a bargaining chip with the United States, preventing trade. If you're familiar with the Kentucky resolutions, was a resolution written by Thomas Jefferson saying that Kentucky had the right to secede from the Union if the government did not address its needs. And the needs that needed to be addressed was trade with New Orleans. You know, so it wasn't getting done in this time period. So that's why I believe that, you know, people started drinking aged whiskey in New Orleans because that's what Kentucky was sending down there to them. And they were sending this whiskey to them because they wanted something that would, the French people down there would drink. And what they're used to drinking is French brandy, cognac, Armagnac, aged in charred barrels. So someone got the idea, let's make our whiskey taste more like French brandy and age it in charred barrels. And they started sending it down there. So my theory is people got down there, particularly after steamboats in the 1820s become popular. They get down to New Orleans. They start drinking this whiskey. They're on their way back, and they're telling the bartender on the steamboat, you know, I'd like to drink some more of that bourbon whiskey I was drinking down on Bourbon Street. Give me some of that Bourbon Street whiskey, or eventually just give me some of that bourbon whiskey.
You mentioned the charred barrels. Of course, that's one of the things that has to happen for a whiskey to be bourbon. It's got to be aged in charred barrels that hadn't been previously used. What does your research tell you about where that idea came from? Because, again, there's a lot of stories about, well, there was a warehouse that caught fire and they just kept the whiskey in the barrels, or there's a lot of these other stories. Tell us about some of these, you know, again, legends that have sprung up and what you did to look into them.
The earliest reference that I have found to charring barrels is 1826. So it's obviously a new idea in the 1820s. You know, and the reference to the charring barrels is actually a letter to John Corliss, a distiller in Bourbon County, from a Lexington grocer who says, I really like your whiskey. I'll take another 100 barrels, but I've been told that if you will burn or char the inside of the barrel as little as a 16th of an inch, it will much improve the flavor. So here's a Lexington grocer telling a Bourbon County distiller how to make bourbon.
Now, when we think of bourbon now, we think of the big names that have a lot of capacity, that have, you know, thousands of barrels at their distilleries. But, you know, take us back to the time when this was a very, this is farmer whiskey, I think is something that you refer to in your book. These are individuals and counties out in the country. How do you, in the time before cell phones and the internet, how does one go about acquiring the knowledge of how to make whiskey?
Whiskey was just simply another commodity. You made your whiskey just like you made your hams and your bacons every winter, you know. There was family tradition on how to make whiskey. You had people, you know, not only the Scotch and Irish and that brand of distillers, but there were a lot of Germans and French and even English people that came here that had a distilling heritage. You know, as a matter of fact, I think the Germans are very much overlooked in their early distilling days. You know, people like Overholt in Pennsylvania and Jacob Baum, who became Jacob Beam, you know, here in Kentucky, were German.
I've been under the impression that the past, say, 10, 20 years was the first, was one of the only real golden ages for bourbon with the resurgence of popularity. But you talk about that there's, in the 20th century, that there were several ups and downs for the bourbon industry. And take us through that. I believe one of them was after the Second World War, where you have a lot of Americans coming home from Europe. Tell us about bourbon at that point.
Well, bourbon at that point is really in a what I consider the golden age, because you have a lot of distillers making whiskey, as much whiskey as they wanted to make, consumers buying it at a reasonable price. They've got a whole lot of choices as to brands and distillers.
Then you write that bourbon sees a real downturn in the 1960s due to a lot of the popular sentiment at the time. And we all know that it was a time of upheaval in American history, but I never had thought about how that might impact, say, the spirits industry. What happened to bourbon in the 60s?
Well, in the 60s, you had the generation that said, don't trust anyone over 30, and we're not going to drink what our parents drank. And what their parents were drinking was whiskey, bourbon, and scotch.
As you know, there is a huge popularity right now worldwide for bourbon, for whiskey in general. And I'm wondering, when you look back, was there some moment, is there some company, is there some person we thank for the reemergence here in the past, say, decade and a half?
There's not any one person that you could give credit to, but it's a lot of things. And to be honest with you, to start with, the credit goes to the Scotch industry. Because, like I said, in the 60s, people weren't drinking whiskey. That included Scotch whiskey. And it was hurting not only the bourbon market, but it was hurting the Scotch whiskey market. So they got together and decided to introduce their single malt scotches into the American market. And the way they decided to do this is to play up on the fact that this was a generation that was, you know, wine and beer drinkers, and that were having, you know, wine and beer clubs and had magazines dedicated to drinking wine and doing wine and cheese pairings and pairing wine with food. And they said, let's do the same thing with scotch. Let's take our single malts there and show them that it can be enjoyed for its flavor. And when they did that, it started bringing interest back into the brown spirits, as they call it, the whiskeys, the aged spirits.
Well, Michael Veach, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Veach is the author of the new book, Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey, An American Heritage. WKU Public Radio spoke to Mr. Veach at the Filson Historical Society in Louisville, where he works as the Associate Curator of Special Collections. You can hear an audio archive of our interview with Mr. Veach, as well as a few web audio extras, at our website, WKYUFM.org. For WKU Public Radio, I'm Kevin Willis.